Yeah, I mean, I assume that, well, I mean, I'm just beginning on this, really. I've read Peter Marshall's book and Ruth's book, but I've got a long way to go. But my understanding of the anarchist position, at least, is it's more of a top-down, non-hierarchical view, where the idea being that you have lots of small local sort of communes and with no central structure. And those organise in a kind of federalist way, and they're spread out and certainly Murray Butching he calls himself a social ecologist to kind of emphasise that, you know, these groups of small local organisations, basically like sort of English parishes, so that the parish, you know, small groups of people control, you know, everyone gets involved in making political decisions, and there's no direction, if you like, or from above, which certainly seemed to be the case that my understanding that Marx was kind of indicating, that, you know, there should always be some kind of authority controlling that, whereas, you know, the anarchist position seems to be, you know, quite separate from that. And certainly what I've read seems to be that was the divide between, well, not just Bakunin, but also Kropotkin and their disagreements with Marx. That's, I mean, I think the anarchists, they seem to accept, rightly so, that Marx's study of the class system, you know, is they all agreed on that. You know, the idea of the labor theory of value, etc., and control of the you know, distribution of the surplus. That was something that they definitely did. There was agreement between the two factions, but it's this idea of having, you know, a more hierarchical structure, you know, where, you know, party officials control local. Make the decisions rather than on a local basis.
Well, again, Marx didn't say any of that. I mean, one thing that Marx and Engels did were in favour of at one stage was the idea of production. They never really drilled down to the level of how, you know, the post-capitalist society or association of workers, of free workers or whatever it was that they called it. They never really drilled down to how it would actually, you know, be run. There was no—I don't think there was anywhere where they suggested that there would be party officials and it was a hierarchy. But one thing they did have the idea of was central planning of production. Now that could be perfectly democratic throughout the whole population. You know, there's no, that doesn't by itself imply a hierarchy. But the idea of central planning, I think, has been sort of abandoned. We don't really subscribe to that at all now. I mean, and I think it's been overtaken by technology in any case. I mean, you know, if one was going to operate the post-capitalist society now, the idea of doing it centrally, planning all of it, seems a bit far-fetched, and there are good reasons to suppose that most production could be local, kind of in the way you describe, really. So, you know, there isn't really any kind of, certainly not in Marx, unless somebody wants to correct me, nothing about party officials or, you know, hierarchies in that sense at all. That would be completely against everything that Marx and Engels stood for, as far as we understand it.
Richard, were you wanted to speak there?
Yeah, I was just wanted to pick up on a couple of points, really, that kind of like quite interest me. One of the issues is, I mean, going right back to Paddy's question about, you know, are we anarchists? Are we anarcho-communists? I think the question really depends on what kind of anarchists you're talking about, because anarchists are a very varied bunch. And they kind of range everything from anarcho-communists, which I think we would say we were or most of us anyway, would say, well, we were closest to, you know, down through syndicalists and mutualists who want a sort of, you know, sort of a society of competing co-ops, with, some kind of proprietarian exchange and all this kind of stuff, which we on the whole, I think, would reject. So I think that's one point. But I really wanted to also pick up on and sort of kind of pick up on Nick's point, because I think very, very much, you know, when you get into a debate between anarchists and non-market socialists like ourselves, libertarian socialists like ourselves, with a Marxian bent, I think very often the argument always comes down to this thing about the dictatorship of the proletariat. And I think it really, really needs to be stressed that, when we're talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat, or when Marx was talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat, he wasn't talking about what we understand by those words today. Because the word dictatorship, for example, really only acquired its modern meaning somewhere in the middle of the 20th century. In Marx's time, it meant little more than government. All governments were dictatorships. I mean, the British government in the 19th century was has been described as a dictatorship. The Paris Commune, which was one of the most democratic forms of organization, of government organization in the 19th century, was described as a dictatorship. Dictatorship to Marx did not actually mean an authoritarian top-down form of government at all. It just meant that in his day, all governments were the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, the dictatorship of the capitalist class. And all he was proposing was, as a very initial and temporary arrangement, to exchange that for a government, a dictatorship of the working class, for the period necessary in order to effect a transition to communism. And as soon as you move to communism, that all disappeared. So the dictatorship of the proletariat really is not to be understood in the way that those words were to Marx, is not to be or to us, is not to be understood in the way that those words actually mean today. So no, Marx was not actually arguing with Bakunin over having an authoritarian regime. In fact, both Marx and Bakunin actually accused each other of being statists. Marx was accusing Bakunin of being a statist because, you know, he was keen on these secret societies that would actually affect revolutions. So the two, there's been a lot of misunderstanding. There was a lot of misunderstanding, I think, between the two men. I think more to do with temperament than anything else. And I think that's gone on right down to today when discussions between anarchists and socialists of our kind, libertarian socialists of our kind, start talking. But there's a lot of misrepresentation, I think, on both sides. I think we both actually get stuck in paradigms which really don't help the discussion at all. Anyway, that's my take on it.
Yeah, that was very, very interesting. Would you say that Stalin and Fidel Castro and others, they went to the point whereby, you know, that revolution was controlled from a top-down perspective, but when the revolution was achieved, of course they took over and remained in power and became effectively totalitarian. But that was something that Marx would have disagreed with, because Marx's view then, this is my understanding of what you've said, and I'm sure you're right, just to clarify it, that Marx believed that once the revolution had been obtained, those structures would dissolve, dissipate, and then the workers would control, would take over and run society.
Marx was very much for bottom-up revolution. I mean, he stressed this point time and time again. You know, people like Blanqui, who sort of came out of the French Revolution, who was used to propose revolutionary elites who would actually take control take central power on behalf of the not even on behalf of the working class. He was proposing effectively a dictatorship over the proletariat. And there is some sense in which Marx precisely chose the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat actually to try to contrast with this idea of dictatorship of the over the proletariat. So Marx insisted over and over and over again, right throughout his life, that the revolution must be the work of the working class themselves. It could not be brought about by some kind of elite professional revolutionaries of Blanqui's kind or of Lenin's kind. It couldn't be done that way, simply because if you think about it, if you're introducing a society of mutual cooperation, you actually have to really understand that that's what you're aiming for. And it can only be brought about by conscious members of the working class, conscious of the fact that they are trying to create a society of mutual association and not top-down politics. So no, Marx would have absolutely rejected. I'm always a bit nervous about this because nobody has a crystal ball and people do change their minds. But if you just read Marx and also his commitment throughout his life at every stage of his life, even before he became a communist, to libertarian ideas, even before he became a communist, he was agitating for freedom of the press. He was totally against any kind of authoritarian top-down regime whatsoever.
Can I just add to that that I think it's pretty clear that not only would Marx have rejected what happened in Russia after Stalin and came to power, or Cuba after Fidel Castro came to power, he would not only reject that, he would have rejected the very coming to power of those people, the kind of revolution with which they came to power, which, as Richard had said, was a top-down revolution. It wasn't a revolution of the a socially conscious majority, and therefore it wasn't a Marxist revolution at all. In fact, although it was called that, and it's in that sense that on numerous occasions in our journal, The Socialist Standard, there have been articles on the way that Lenin and other such authoritarian leaders have actually distorted the whole sense of what Marx stood for.
I've just posted a quote in the links thing, Engels. I just quickly sort of found that, just to show that... He wrote this sometime after both Marx and Engels had got very excited and carried away with themselves in 1848 when they thought revolution was happening all over Europe. And then when it sort of fizzled out, they took a rather longer view of the matter and realised that you just can't do it like that. You can't have these kind of elites who carry the thing forward by themselves. And you know. And they took the view after that that all that you would get would be some sort of modified form of capitalism. So, you know, they could have predicted really what happened in Russia after they were both dead.
Yeah, this isn't the kind of interpretation, Marx, that of course you would get from the SWP or people like that, because they have their own particular view. Their concept of revolution is like it's in a rather strange way. It's tied to this historical failed revolution in Russia, well, ultimately failed revolution in Russia. And so they take a very different interpretation of Marx, but it's an interpretation that we would claim is not actually sustained by a detailed reading of Marx himself. In fact, as Howard said, there is, I think, in 1950-51 edition of the Standard, there is an article called Lenin Distorts Marx, and it actually goes through Lenin's writings and wherever he quotes Marx, and picking out the little careful changes he made to Marx's comments to make Marx say almost the opposite of what in fact he was saying.
Sorry, was that Howard speaking?
No, I was just going to say. That was Richard.
He mentioned about this Lenin.
Distorts Marx.
Distorts Marx. Do you have do you put a link to these somewhere? I've no idea how to use this Discord thing. It's the first time I've seen it. Really, first time I've used it is this evening. Or no idea.
Are you able to put a link onto that article? It would be on the party's website.
I'm just going to have a look for it now.
It's a useful link.
It's not in this chat. One of the channels.
No, are you able to access the useful links page?
Yeah.
Right. Well, actually, you'll notice that Keith has put
the time. Right. Yeah, that's right. Saving the time. Yeah.
The Battle of Democracy and Karl Marx Our Contemporary. Strongly recommended, by the way. But Paddy's put the quote on from Engels. But
okay, I see that now. Yeah.
Whether Paddy can put a link to the article in a back issue of the Socialist Standard, which is called Lenin Distorts Marx. I suppose I could try and do that, but I think Paddy's rather better than me at that kind of thing.
I can't seem to. I've just done a quick.
I can put my finger on it if you like.
Do, Richard, because I just did a quick search on our website and it doesn't come up under Lenin Distorts Marx, but I mean, no. We definitely have got that article.
Yeah, I've tried the search engine for some reason and misses it. I've got a. I know where I can find the exact copy, so it'll be on the SPGB on the SPG website, and I'll see if I can find it before we finish this talk. I'll try and find it and put it on the useful links section. So if you go on, I'll try and find it for next.
Meanwhile, I might point out to Matt, who does the website, that when we did a search on Lenin Distorts Marx, it doesn't come up.
it's sometime in the 1970s, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a fair bit on our website, Nick, about Lenin, so... You know,
I noticed it all changed a couple of weeks back.
The website?
Yeah.
Oh, for the better, I hope.
if I may come in here with just something slightly different. I absolutely agree the historic aspect is so important. But... what is our basic aim of socialism, Socialist Party of Great Britain, is to overcome capitalism, overthrow capitalism, whatever word you want. Because when we look at all the various, what we call, inverted commas, regimes that have wanted to call themselves socialist or communist, they have had to continue with the capitalist system. There isn't a way out of it because it's this, the monetary system. And that aspect of this whole thing, I'd become very disenchanted with any kind of politics until I, just by chance, discovered the SPG, 15, 16 years ago, something like that. And what came home to me from reading the information from the party was just this very thing of, without destroying the monetary system, that whole thing that capitalism is based on, there's absolutely no way anybody, any country, any whatever you like, state, whatever you want to call them, there's no way they can run what we would call a proper socialist system. It has to be the worldwide goal, so that we can actually then really get round to organising things. So it is, if you like, let's call it the proletariat. It doesn't matter what you call it. We all understand what we're talking about here. But it's about the vast majority of the people having control and organising the way that their communities are to be run, to be lived in, whatever. I think I've finished. It's sort of a very basic thing. But for me, it's absolutely vitally important that this part is understood about the SPGB.
Just to mention, I've just posted in that link for How Lenin Distorted Marx. It's on the Useful Links page.
Yeah, I've just posted in a search link for a whole load of Lenin articles on the website as well. So there's a whole string of them.
Okay. So it's in the April 1970 edition. So you've got it, have you? You don't need me to put up a link. Is that right?
I think the one in the April 1970 edition is different from the ones we've got the links to. But I mean, they're obviously all saying something similar. But there's quite a bit of material here for Nick if he wants to sort of have a look at it anyway.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'll just put up the April 1971 as well.
Yeah. Might as well.
The thing I've noticed when talking to anarchists, it's actually not that question of authoritarianism that comes up, because usually, in my experience anyway, because normally, you know, we can sort of dispose of that fairly quickly, and there are a fair number of anarchists who do actually, you know, understand that our position is, and they know that there is this sort of libertarian Marxist current. Although, you know, we don't really think of it as libertarian Marxism, we just think of it as like Marxism. But the thing that normally comes up is this whole question about parliament, the parliamentary road, as it were. This is one of the things that seems to a lot of, it seems to a lot of anarchists quite a big, sort of big deal, you know, that you can't get revolution through the parliamentary road. You know, it has to be some other way. Seems to be a sort of sticking point, more so for them, I always think, than us. But I don't know. Maybe other members think differently. I know some members think quite strongly about that.
They make out that the parliamentary road for us is a fetish. No, that we utterly dependent on the parliamentary rule. We do a lot, to assemble that. So we're not dependent on the parliamentary rule. In fact, we turn around and say that if the democratic rule is not available, we take violent means to obtain the revolutionary process. And the other thing is, as well, we also try and explain as best we can that we see, is it the word duopoly? I'm not sure now. Anyway, it's along parallel lines, you know, that is action outside the parliament taking place as well. Right? But having said that, in my mind, right, a vote of some kind or other will be necessary so that we've got a really rough estimate on how many people do support the revolutionary process and how we can go forward then in regards to the production and distribution of human needs. Without that estimate, we're going to have great difficulties.
Brian, we don't say we'll take violent means. No, I mean, that isn't a good way to put it, I'm afraid. I mean, you know, what we say is that once the vast majority of people want socialism, it will be there for the taking. Now, all right, it's you know, who knows, it's feasible that somebody might try to sort of stop that happening with violence, in which case, you know, we'd have to do something about that. But to frame it as, you know, are taking violent action somehow, if we can't get our way is, you know, it's, you know, I don't think it makes the right impression anyway, put it like that. And it's not something we, you know, we would say, not in those terms anyhow.
I think Nick...
I may have worded it badly.
I think Nick was going to say something. I think you got cut off, Nick, did you? Come in.
Well, no, I didn't want to interrupt because you talked. One of my understanding of the anarchist thought is this idea of... one of the big sticking points is the idea of the state. I mean, and parliament's kind of is kind of different because it works under the state regime, and you know parliaments can change, but they can still all working under the same structure of the state. And I think the anarchist position is the whole purpose of the state is to support and protect the interests of the elite over the workers. So I think the anarchists argue that really to have a completely free libertarian society, you know, it needs to be stateless, because any state would in the end always degenerate into supporting an elite in the end.
Yeah, we think that too.
Yeah, we would agree with that. The debate about the state is that we have with the anarchists is slightly different. We don't think that a socialist society would have a state. We think a socialist, we use the word socialism, communism the same, to mean the same as Marx did. We think that the state will just simply not exist in a socialist society. And we agree absolutely that the state is here to maintain the monopoly of power of the capitalist class. And it's for that reason that we actually take the view that you have to take the state, that you actually have to take control of the state partly to prevent it from being used against you. I mean, the anarchists, I think, often hold up the Spanish Civil War as an example of anarchism in action. But one of the very important reasons why it failed. I mean, there were many reasons why it failed, but one of the immediate reasons was it failed was that they didn't take hold of the state, and the state was used against them very, 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 very determinedly. So we hold that you have to take the state, not because we're going to use the state to run socialism, but because the state has to be taken in order to take capitalism out of the hands of the capitalist class. So it's a kind of a little more complicated than just whether, you know, we retain the state or not.
I suppose the difficulty becomes in the mechanism of how one achieves that in a non-violent way, and to get the support of the mass of the people that believe. I mean, I guess the majority of the people that you asked in Western Europe couldn't even contemplate the idea of the state not existing. It's a permanent thing in their view. So, I mean, how do you convince them otherwise? Is that's quite difficult, I guess.
Yeah, $64,000 question. We just carry on trying, basically. You know, it's a historical process, among other things. You know, we sort of keep the idea of socialism alive and try and promote it as much as possible. You know, something needs to happen in capitalism to sort of convince people that, you know, the system they live under isn't in their interest. What we're offering is sort of there ready, as it were, for people to use.
Yeah, I think people, what Nick's saying about what people think of the state is right. You know, people can't imagine life without the state. But I think it needs to be clarified what the state actually is. Because there are lots of aspects of the state which are, you know, completely devoted to the coercive control of the population. We know that. And we want to, you know, we want to abolish those things as fast as possible. But the state also does other things, because it controls everything that happens. It also controls those things which would be quite useful. I mean, you only have to think of the health service, or you know, how making sure the traffic lights work and things like that. Things that are actually quite useful, sort of planning civil engineers and things like that. There are all kinds of things that you'd probably want to retain, just not the coercive part. So what you'd want to do is dismantle all the useless bits that make up the capitalist state, and keep the useful bits like the health service, emergency services, and stuff like that. Except, you know, not the police, perhaps, but so. It becomes a bit easier then to explain to people. We're not trying to turn the clock back to kind of medieval barbarism. What we're trying to do is upgrade what is a fairly barbaric system already, capitalism, into one that functions in the interests of the majority. And that means keeping a health service, in fact, improving a health service, and doing other things that are not state controlled anymore. They're controlled by the people, you and me and everybody else. So if you approach the question of the state in that way, I think rather than sort of giving it this sort of totemic monolithic image of coercion, I think you can get a lot more sympathy. People can understand that if you sort of separate out the bits and say, no, we just keep the bits that are useful and get rid of all the rest that's not.
I think Paddy's point is right and important, and I also think it can be generalised. What makes a socialist society a possibility is the existence of capitalism. All kinds of features of capitalist society can be taken on by socialists to make a socialist society run. So systems of communication, transportation, production of those kinds of goods and so on. So I think that's something to emphasise when we're talking to people about socialism. It isn't as if we're advocating establishing a form of society from scratch. We are taking on those aspects of capitalism which have made socialism possible.
Just another aspect of the parliamentary thing, which, as I said before, it does seem to be a sticking point with some anarchists, even though there have been anarchists who have stood for parliament. Ian Bone was one who stood for parliament at one point. But nevertheless, it's fairly unusual, I think, for anarchists to do that. But I was having a conversation recently with some friends of mine who are anarchists, and just out of the conversation popped a really interesting proposition, which was, supposing we're having a revolution, and, you know, we're all against the idea of voting. We think that's just silly. We don't need it as a yardstick to measure popular support for a revolution, because you can just look out your damn window and see that for yourself. It'll be pretty damned obvious at that point that you don't need a count of heads to see that there's massive overwhelming support for a revolution. So I don't really buy that argument. But let's just suppose that lots and lots of workers, say, possibly even a majority of workers, did want to have a vote because they're used to the whole idea of legitimate voting, transparent democratic procedures, and they did want to have a vote. Would we oppose it? You know, would anarchists oppose it? Would they oppose workers saying, we want to see this in writing, we want to see this done legitimately? Would anarchists oppose it? I can't imagine why they would. I think it would be incredibly inept of revolutionaries to wrong-foot themselves in that way and put themselves in the wrong. And in the process, incidentally, give reactionaries, anti-revolutionaries, the opportunity to win an election by default. Imagine that situation. It seems to me that, you know, if... And one of our writers in the Standard, I think, put it really well, really quite well, quite recently. And he said, it doesn't matter what you or I think about whether to vote or whether revolution should have a vote in it. If the point of revolution comes, you just try stopping workers from having a vote and see how far you get. I thought that was a really good argument.
Depends what you were voting for, though.
Well, the revolution, you know. Abolishing the state, abolishing capitalism. And capitalism. So that it was legitimate. Whatever we thought, you know, I think most workers would probably be in favour of seeing it done legitimately.
I've never been, you know, a very strong supporter of this idea that we must, under all circumstances, win the state by a vote. I think there are all kinds of issues there. I think it will depend very much on the circumstances of the time. But what, I do think there are very good and legitimate reasons for doing it. And one of them is just as Paddy says, but there is another one, in that there may well be a section of the working class who is not ultimately convinced by and committed to a revolutionary transformation of society to socialism. So it may well be that those more conservative elements will be brought on board if it can be shown that there is a legitimate, in the traditional sense, a legitimate transfer of power from the capitalist class to the working class through the voting process. So I think the legitimation idea does have some, I don't think it has sort of ontological importance, you know, real importance, but it does have psychological, it could well have psychological importance for a lot of people. And that's one reason that I would you know, support it if it were in other ways obvious that that's the way we needed to go.
One reason we would need to have that, I'm thinking of worldwide rather than England or whatever, or Parliament or whatever, that in the United States would need at least 75% of the population to overcome the Constitution. And everywhere else would need it as well. So I can't see the reasons why some of these anarchists, they think we're living in the 18th century, like the Paris Revolution in the 1780 something. One thing I always thought anarchists didn't like about political parties, every politician elected becomes corrupt in their experience, you know, in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. So that's one of the things I've always thought the anarchists were afraid of. How would you control somebody elected that, ruling, you know, place like Parliament in England and in the United States, the Congress and the Senate? Would you control them? If they get elected, they have new legal power. That's something. But we're not really talking about world revolution at the moment. We seem to be concentrating on England and Europe rather than how would that be affected worldwide?
Well, I think the anarchist would have this idea of a delegate so that, you know, where they'd be voted in locally, and if the delegates chose to misrepresent those, then they could be withdrawn at any time. But that seems to be their argument.
I mean, we would say exactly the same thing. We would send delegates to Parliament so that if they started voting in ways that were contrary to working class interests or to the desires of their electorate, then they could simply be withdrawn. I mean, we would say that also.
There seems to be a hell of a lot of synergy between what you believe and the anarchists, to me. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's why we kind of asked the question tonight.
I think one of the interesting things is if you go back historically and you look at the feud between Marx and Bakunin, I think you'll find there that ultimately the disagreement between Marx and Bakunin, even at that fundamental level, wasn't between what they were aiming for. They were both aiming pretty much, but they both had pretty much the same concept of socialism. The difference between them was very much in terms of how they got there. And, if you look at their various ideas, if you look at Bakunin's ideas, Bakunin was the kind of a little bit of a wild man, and he kind of changed his views about things kind of quite regularly. So, you know, there's more heat than light, I think, in terms of, sort of face-to-face disagreements between anarchists and socialists of our ilk, at any rate.
Yeah, if I can just come in with one of my whimsical homespun analogies. This was another conversation I'd had with some people, and we sort of, where we boiled it down to was a bunch of people arguing about going on holiday, and they all kind of agreed that they wanted to go to Spain. They just couldn't agree on whether to fly or take the train. And this is kind of, quite often, this is really just all it boils down to between anarchists and us. It's like, you know, we all kind of agree that we want to get to Spain. It's just, how do we get there? Other groups, of course, want to go to Moldova. So we don't agree with those people at all.
Is that a good place to leave it, Paddy? It's been quite a good discussion. We've been going for about 90 minutes. Probably most of what people have wanted to say has been said. Very interesting to hear what Nick had to say as well, because we've not seen him on this site before.
Nick, you're very welcome. If you hadn't already worked out, you know that you are. Please come back. Please come back to other groups. We've got a talk on Friday as well. So. I can't remember what Friday's talk is on.
Populism.
Oh, populism. Okay. Somebody's going to speak on that. So do come along to other stuff.
Well, now I'm retired. I've got plenty of time on my hands.
No,
well, I've got
more
reading to do.
Okay.
Can I just say, if people have a look at the speaking queue, I've stuck a beautiful poem there from a Cuban poet, Nicholas Guillem. That was written in the aftermath of the Cuban Revolution. It's just very uplifting. I mean, I'm not advocating it as a socialist poem, although he probably thought it was. But it's just a lovely uplifting thing, and I hope it gives people something nice to go to bed with.
Thanks, Alan. Cheers.
Okay. Well, I suppose we'll call it a night then.
Cheers.
Cheers, thanks a lot.
All right, then.
Thank you.
All right, thanks everyone for coming.
Cheers, thanks a lot. Yep, see you soon.